The United States Supreme Court is set once again to make a major decision about abortion in America. This time, the FDA's approval of the abortion pill is front and center. Expert legal and medical analysis of what's at stake.
Really, that's what it was about, making sure nobody goes hungry.
A model program in the Rocky Mountains addresses the needs of the hungry and the homeless. Catholic Charities of Central Colorado is in the spotlight as we hear from a homeless mother who says she now has hope for the future.
I think the college culture today kind of pushes, like, it's about you.
Keeping the faith on campus, we go to the University of Delaware to follow one student's path on her Lenten journey.
You work with colors, you work with art, you work with ideas.
And a visit to one of the world's leading makers of stained glass windows, beautifying churches around the globe. EWTN News In Depth starts now.
Regardless of what one's opinions are of abortion, we should all agree that no woman, no girl should be left all alone to take these drugs without the care of a doctor.
Days prior to argument before the U.S. Supreme Court, a plaintiff's attorney expresses the view of the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine and a group of pro-life doctors, asking the high court to restrict the use of mifepristone, the chemical abortion pill. That, as new data reveals, the percentage of chemical abortions is on the rise. Welcome to EWTN News In Depth. New and revealing information this week about abortion in America. The number of abortions has increased almost 2 years since the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in the landmark case Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization. That growing number, despite dozens of states now limiting the procedure or banning it completely. That data was gathered by the Guttmacher Institute, a pro-abortion research organization, which says there were more than 1 million abortions in 2023. That's the highest number since 2011, and a 10% jump since 2020, the last year for which comprehensive estimates are available. With surgical abortion less available, chemical abortions, the most common way to end the lives of preborn children, made up nearly two-thirds of all abortions in the United States, compared to just half in 2020. On Tuesday, the Supreme Court will once again take on the issue of abortion, this time looking at the FDA approval process for the use of mifepristone.
We've heard abortion proponents or, you know, supporters of this drug say that that this drug is safer than Advil or safer than Tylenol. And we know that 1 in 25 people who take Advil at the FDA approved dose don't end up in the emergency rooms.
Dr. Christina Francis, CEO of the American Association of Pro-Life OBGYNs, is one of the plaintiffs in the first high stakes abortion case at the Supreme Court since the overturning of Roe versus Wade in 2022. In FDA versus the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, she and other pro-life medical doctors are challenging the Food and Drug Administration's approval of mifepristone, the first of two pills used in the abortion pill regimen. The drug works by cutting off necessary nutrients for the unborn baby's survival, essentially starving the child to death. In an interview alongside one of her attorneys, she says the FDA removed important safeguards that it had in place for mifepristone since its approval in 2000.
You know, when the FDA originally approved these drugs, it recognized that they were high-risk drugs and there needed to be certain safeguards in place.
In 2021, it removed one of the biggest safeguards, in-person doctor visits, allowing these pills to be sent through the mail.
This is really dangerous for women because it then does not allow anyone to ensure that she does not have an ectopic pregnancy, which is a life-threatening complication of pregnancy. It also doesn't enable us to ensure that we know how far along in the pregnancy she is. And again, the rate of complications increased dramatically the farther along she is.
Last year, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals agreed with the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, ruling that safeguards should be put back in place for mifepristone. The Justice Defense Department, along with mifepristone manufacturer Danko Labs, immediately appealed that decision to the U.S. Supreme Court, reiterating in its petition that the drug is safe, saying, study after study has shown that when mifepristone is taken in accordance with its approved conditions of use, serious adverse events are exceedingly rare.
I would like to invite the DOJ to come into my emergency room and see the women that I have cared for that are suffering these horrendous complications. FDA acknowledges that 1 in 25 women, and this was even before these essential safeguards were removed, 1 in 25 women will go to the emergency room for a complication.
Now, the High Court will have the final say on mifepristone, with oral arguments scheduled next week and a decision likely out in the summer. Many worry that the scope of the case goes beyond mifepristone and could even impact the FDA's authority to approve other drugs. Kelly Fedorik, senior counsel at the Alliance Defending Freedom, says this case only concerns mifepristone.
We are unaware of any other time where the FDA has done something with the safeguards it originally said were necessary and then chose to remove those safeguards for a drug they knew was high risk. They acted recklessly and should be held accountable for that recklessness.
Joining us to discuss the medical, legal, and policy implications of this case are Dr. Karen Pohalis, family physician and member of the Catholic Medical Association, and attorney Heather Hacker Comingback, former assistant solicitor general in the Texas Attorney General's office. Great to have both of you to discuss this. Heather, let's start with you. We just heard the facts of this case. The FDA and its drug approval process is a big part of it, which many think it's only about abortion. Has the Supreme Court ever looked at the FDA like this?
They certainly have not looked at the FDA in a context related to the abortion pill like this. So, you know, there are a couple of important issues that the court will look at before it even gets to the FDA approval process. First is the issue of standing and whether or not the doctors and the medical associations that are the plaintiffs in this case have standing to bring the lawsuit. That's one of the questions presented to the court, and I anticipate there will be a lot of argument about that at the oral arguments that will be held soon. Then the second issue is the FDA regulations, and actually in this part of the case before the Supreme Court, the initial FDA approval of the drug is not at issue, but the court will be looking at the 2016 and the 2021 changes that the FDA made to the protocol surrounding the use of mifepristone.
Well, those are certainly things to watch while arguments continue. Dr. Pohalis, you are rumored to be one of the doctors that will be at the Supreme Court on Tuesday morning. And we have video from outside the court 2 years ago after the Dobbs decision was announced. It was quite the scene. Tell us why you're compelled to be there this time as a medical doctor to talk about the effects of mifepristone and medical abortions.
I feel compelled to be there for my patients. I have cared for women who have started mifepristone abortions, and I have seen things happen that we wouldn't really allow anywhere else in medicine as far as the safety of the women who are choosing to undergo this. And I just feel like I need to be there to be a voice for them at a day when the Supreme Court is hearing it. And a number of my fellow physicians are going to be joining me because we feel the same way.
Now, when you say that you've seen things you wouldn't allow, what do those complications look like for the first or second dose of mifepristone?
Right. So the part of the when they moved the regulations in 2016 and then again in 2021, we moved from initially it being that the women had to have 3 in-person visits where you assess to make sure the pregnancy was in the uterus and how far along the woman was, because often their guesses are not correct. And to make sure of safety, are we starting an abortion on a woman who has a pregnancy in the uterus and is she at the correct gestational age? We don't have that anymore. So I have a patient where she was started on one at over 12 weeks and it's only approved up to 10. And she ended up in an emergency room with complications and had to have things taken care of in the emergency room. I've had a patient with a prior history of ectopic who got her abortion pills by telehealth and wasn't told that with a prior ectopic that she should have really had another ultrasound because your risk of ectopic is higher if you've had one before. They just sent her the pills and she took them. She ended up not having a second ectopic, but that was somebody taking a big risk on something that I feel is unreasonable given the data.
It's certainly very, very risky. Heather, this is the first post-Dobbs abortion case at the Supreme Court. Do you think the controversial nature of the issue will affect how the Supreme Court makes its decision again?
I certainly hope not. I mean, the court's job is to look at the law and decide based on the law and not based on how controversial the issue is. So, you know, I hope that they will, you know, give credence to both sides of the issue. They have certainly a lot of briefs before them, not only briefs from the parties, but also briefs from many amici curiae, which are friend of the court briefs, presenting a lot of different information and perspectives. So the court certainly has a big job to do here. And I think that they will apply the law as it's written and as is correct. And hopefully they won't be, you know, dissuaded from doing that by the controversial nature of the issue.
And so then if they're not dissuaded, what are the potential outcomes of the case? Is it a rollback to 7-week use of the abortion pill and a doctor visit requirement?
So what would happen here is only the 2016 and 2021 changes are at issue in this part of the case. They did challenge the 2000 approval, but this is only on a preliminary relief, an appeal of the preliminary relief that was granted. So if the court were to find that the plaintiffs have standing and it were to agree with the plaintiffs on the 2016 and 2021 changes, then essentially the regime would go back to what it was in 2016 before the changes were made.
Dr. Prohalis, a Senate judiciary hearing this week brought expert panelists to discuss abortion and in vitro fertilization. Louisiana Senator John Kennedy pressed Lourdes Rivera, president of the pro-abortion group Pregnancy Justice, on a gestational limit. Let's take a quick listen.
If the mother's healthy and the baby's healthy, would you support an abortion the day before birth?
Actually, that is not how abortion care works.
Yes, ma'am, but
Senator,
would you support that? You say no restrictions.
That is called labor and delivery, Senator.
But you support no restrictions.
That is not how abortion care works, and it's
sure
really,
it does.
That is not how abortion care works.
My question is simple.
Doctor, what is your reaction to that interaction? Is abortion at the end of term really labor and delivery?
Abortion at the end of the pregnancy is basically going to happen like a labor and delivery, but you're either making moves to deliver a child that is no longer alive, or you're delivering a child that perhaps is alive but not able to succeed outside the womb without help and not providing that help. Say if a child is premature or has other health issues, if you're delivering a child and that child needs to be going to a NICU or needs oxygen or needs normal care, and you're denying that care, basically you're delivering a living child to allow it to pass.
So they're allowing children to die. The hearing also tried to pair protections for in vitro fertilization with access to abortions, a very weird combination. Do you find that comparison medically dissonant in that you're talking about the life of an embryo and preserving it, but also the death of a child in the womb?
I'm not familiar with the tie-in that you're speaking of, but I think sometimes when we look at abortion and look at in vitro, we are looking in some ways at different sides of the same coin. Everyone's talking about the case in Alabama that those embryos had standing and were considered to be life that was worth protecting and that the parents could sue over their accidental loss. I think we need to look at that and say, well, if people were upset over that, how does that parlay into looking at an abortion at 4 weeks gestation, 6 weeks gestation, 8 weeks? The only difference is time and growth.
Heather, there's one more abortion case being argued next month related to a hospital's obligation to provide abortions to mothers experiencing medical emergencies, potentially protecting an Idaho law that prohibits abortions without a medical exception. Would this oral argument make any difference in that case?
I don't think so. The issues are very different, and so the court is going to be looking at totally different legal issues, I think. I mean, they both involve abortion at a high level, but the legal issues the court will be tangling with are certainly very different.
Well, we'll be looking out for oral argument and coming back to you both for a reaction. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Some legal whiplash this week between the Supreme Court and the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals as justices went back and forth over whether a controversial Texas state border security law could take effect, while legal challenges to it continue through the court system. The state law, known as SB 4, would give local law enforcement officers in Texas the ability to arrest migrants suspected of entering the state illegally and allow state judges to deport migrants to Mexico. The Supreme Court allowed it to take effect early this week, but the appeals court immediately blocked it while it continues to weigh the merits of the case. The Texas legislature passed SB 4 last year amid a record surge in border crossings. But from both the conservative and progressive view, there are concerns and confusion about how local law enforcement will take over what has been the role of the federal immigration office, from lack of local manpower and jail space to the potential legal ramifications of racial profiling.
We don't want a deputy that thinks that they have authorities that actually don't exist crossing the line over into racial profiling and getting themselves and the agency in a whole lot of trouble. For, again, a misdemeanor.
We're not going to be targeting minorities or anything like that. We have to have reason to believe somebody is here illegally or has committed a crime before we will act.
And implementation of SB 4 is further complicated by Mexico, which says it does not consent to receiving a mass number of migrants deported from Texas. The Fifth Circuit has scheduled oral argument for early April to consider SB 4's constitutionality. The courts are very busy right now. More important news from the U.S. Supreme Court ahead. But when we return, we turn our attention to this.
I said, son, I'll never be able to offer you those things as a single parent. But those are things you could work for yourself, you know. He said, Mom, I don't want any of this. I just want to be with you.
Next, a homeless mother shares her sense of hopelessness as she tries to provide for her children. We'll tell you about the one organization she turned to that finally helped.
If you are lost on campus or you're not really sure, like knowing that there's like a God out there.
Young people open to God and spirituality. New data shows reason for optimism as we follow one young woman's spiritual path in this Lenten season.
You feel like time has stopped. Everyone working with the hands, creating masterpieces.
And a masterclass in masterpieces. Coming up a little later, we're in Verona, Italy, to watch the creative process of making some of the world's most beautiful art. EWTN News In Depth is coming right back.
If you really want to get off the streets and you want to make a life again for yourself, you can do it.
Hope for the homeless. A look at a successful support system flourishing in central Colorado, targeting people who are unhoused, as well as those who do have a roof over their heads, but just don't have the income to make ends meet. With skyrocketing rents and high food prices, many people are just a few missing paychecks away from being hungry or homeless. A few weeks ago, EWTN News In Depth brought you an entire program devoted to the problem of homelessness and those trying to help. Today, the story of a single mother living with her children in her car and the fruitless search for assistance until she found Catholic Charities. Here's reporter Brazelle Rages.
It's always one battle after another every day, just trying to survive.
Jessica, a single mother to three young children, has been homeless in Colorado Springs for almost a year now.
Me and my kids really had nowhere to go.
Jessica never thought she'd find her family in this situation. She had a full-time job managing a childcare facility and lived in an apartment. However, while she was pregnant with her youngest child, she had to stop working due to medical reasons.
I was ordered by my doctor to not work for that last month, to be off my feet, because I worked at childcare very actively. So as much as I didn't want to, I took the recommendation of my doctor and I took off.
After giving birth, Jessica was struggling to pay rent. She had no income and no support system, while also taking care of a newborn and trying to recover postpartum. After a few months, she was evicted from her apartment.
after I got evicted after the apartment, we lived in hotels until I ran out of funds.
Jessica and her young children started sleeping in her car. She reached out to countless organizations in hopes of qualifying for a housing program, but was turned down either due to a background check or her children not meeting the age requirements.
So getting a lot of no's is really disheartening when you're in the middle of chaos, too, to keep going. But I keep telling myself 40 no's and I just need one yes.
Jessica explains the everyday battle of being a homeless family, from making sure her children are clothed and fed so that they're ready for school, to trying to look for a job with no gas money. But there is one place she says she can always rely on.
The only place who's told me yes is Catholic Charities. Yes, we'll give you diapers. Yes, we'll walk with you through this and guide you and give you a life coach and parenting classes and whatever to be the best version of you that you want to be.
The Catholic Charities of Central Colorado has a family connection center where families can access a laundry room, clothing closet, marketplace pantry referrals, and even life coaching. Right next to the Family Connection Center is the Helen Hunt campus, where Catholic Charities plans to reconstruct into a homeless family shelter to benefit families like Jessica's.
That need for housing is one of the reasons that we've moved forward with a housing project of our own, which is going to be the 24-unit Helen Hunt campus housing for families. And so, you know, that's a drop in the bucket, but it will matter an awful lot for the 24 families who are there and all the kids who will be able to wake up in the same room day after day.
CEO Andy Barton says they are raising funds for the $9 million Hunt Family Housing Project, which will include a mix of three-bedroom, two-bedroom, one-bedroom, and studio units.
The model for entry in that housing unit will be it's a housing first model, which means that that there will be low barriers in terms of folks coming in. We want to be able to take families straight out of shelter and off the street and get them housed.
Families will be able to stay in the units for 18 to 36 months on a case-by-case basis. The goal for the Hunt Family Housing Project is to serve as transitional housing until families are able to thrive on their own. The estimated groundbreaking is set for spring 2024. A few miles away in downtown Colorado Springs is Marion House.
We just want to get people fed if they're hungry and if they have a need.
Jim Benavides is the director of Marion House, where they feed the homeless and the poor free and nutritious meals twice a day.
It's a nutritional meal, so there's a casserole every day. That could be any protein that we have on stock, a green salad, fruit salad. There's a dessert involved.
Behind me, you can see the Marion House kitchen, where they feed about 300 people every day. And over here, we have the marketplace.
Catholic Charities of Central Colorado opened up the Marketplace Food Pantry in February of 2021 to address food instability gaps. Like a supermarket, the Marketplace has a selection of fresh fruits and vegetables, dairy, meat, cereals, and grains. Clients can schedule an appointment and shop just as they would at a standard grocery store.
Our folks that shop in the marketplace, they're actually housed. They have to have refrigeration and cooking equipment. But we get them a 10-day supply of food that will help stretch throughout the month.
Well, it definitely helps us financially. There's no doubt about it.
Catherine Lynn Benner used to be homeless at a point in her life and relied on Marion House for her meals. Now she has a full-time job and is a client for Marketplace.
When you're homeless, you stop believing. When somebody reaches out to you and there's a program that you know that if you're willing to work hard for it, that's going to help you, the whole way of thinking completely changes. So I want to say thank you so much. You've gone way and beyond on what I ever expected that I would be able to receive and achieve by the help that you've given me. So thank you.
Rasal Regis, EWTN News in Depth.
Another organization that supported Jessica and her children when they were on the streets, Safe families. The organization connected Jessica with volunteer families that temporarily housed, clothed, and fed her children as she looked for work. Katie Coetzer is the family coach coordinator of Safe Families, Pikes Peak chapter. Her team worked closely with Catholic Charities to make sure Jessica's children had a safe place to stay. Thank you so much for joining us, Katie. Your organization serves a very unique mission. How do you help children stay off the streets of your Colorado community?
Thank you for having me. We work with partnered churches throughout Colorado Springs of volunteers who are vetted and trained and have done all the background checks to be able to safely house children that are in families facing an unimaginable crisis, including homelessness.
Now, children, of course, are very vulnerable, and we know that we want to make sure that they're safe. How do you ensure that these partner families are properly vetted?
So we follow a redacted version of the Colorado foster care laws, and so we don't have the exact same ones as foster care since we're not foster care, but we do all of the background checks, sex offender checks. They do extensive training as well as interviews in their home and home safety checks to ensure that homes are safe and that even our volunteers have proper and right motives for being involved with Safe Families.
Now, even though you are using something similar to the government, how does your work differ from the way that the government is trying to help families who find themselves in a homeless situation?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. We work in partnership with Department of Human Services, but one difference that I would say is that we seek to strengthen families. So our hostings are all temporary. They're not long-term. They can go up to 6 months, but the goal is to strengthen a family unit so that they can be together again. So the hostings are temporary, and meanwhile, while the children are being hosted, other volunteers are working closely with the parents or the grandparents or guardians to support them, to help them reach their goals and stabilize their crisis.
That's beautiful, to help support the parents themselves. Now, you did say that you work with churches, but how does that collaboration work? How do you work with churches to provide housing for families and children in particular?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we seek to mobilize the church. So we work in partnership with churches throughout Colorado Springs that already have existing Safe Families volunteers. And we create circles of support within that church community so that they are a team that is trained and vetted and ready to provide a circle of support around a family facing a crisis.
Now, that sounds like a lot of work. It's beautiful work, but it sounds very intense. When we think of homelessness, we often don't think of families. What are the greatest needs of families who struggle to find housing?
Mm-hmm. Yes, this is a big problem. In Colorado Springs, we have had many meetings with departments throughout our city, and it is a tremendous need as housing prices and such go up. Oftentimes, we have families that will come to us while they have been living in their car, and or they were just recently evicted. And our main priority is how can we support them and keep their children safe during that period of time while mom or dad seeks to find adequate housing. And I would say the biggest need, honestly, is to provide extended family-like support, so people that they can text, that they can call on, that they can reach out to, that are less bound by some of the restrictions of other agencies.
That's really important, that building community that you described. Well, aside from finances, though, what unique barriers then do homeless families face when they're finding housing?
There's a lot of layers to that. I think some of that can be the situation of their job, can be situation even of having to get children back and forth to school when they don't have a set address. The daily uncertainty of where are we going to be staying tonight, how will my children get to school tomorrow. There are a lot of factors and tremendous barriers for families facing homelessness.
Well, we are grateful for all of your work, and we'll be praying for more success in the work that you're doing. Thank you so much, Katie.
Thank you for having me.
Safe Families has chapters around the country. If you would like to learn how you can help or even volunteer your own home, go to their website at safefamilies.org. The Pope's reflections right before we head into Holy Week, and a young person's perspective of faith during this Lenten season. That's all ahead when we come back.
We celebrated yesterday St. Joseph's Solemnity, patron of the Universal Church. I would like with you to entrust to his patronage the Church and the whole world, and above all the fathers, who in him have a unique model to imitate. To St. Joseph, we also commend the people of martyred Ukraine and the Holy Land, Palestine and Israel, who suffer so much from the horror of war.
Pope Francis calling once again for peace in war-torn Ukraine and the Middle East during his weekly general audience, asking for the special intercession of St. Joseph, the foster father of Jesus. The Church's celebration of Joseph comes just days before the beginning of Holy Week and provides Catholics a foretaste of the joys of Easter. As we enter the last week of Passiontide and the countdown to Easter, the Church asks Catholics to examine their Lenten journey. Have they used this penitential season to grow closer to God through prayer, fasting, and almsgiving? Or did well-intentioned commitments take second place to the hustle and bustle of life? And how does that look for young Catholic adults practicing their faith within a peer group that is becoming more and more secular? Mark Irons has this Catholic Life report.
Everybody that's on a college campus right now is looking for community. Like, you're constantly searching for, like, where can I be fulfilled?
Kathleen Knezik is a senior at the University of Delaware. Like many other college-age students, she juggles a packed schedule filled with studies, a social life, and planning for the future. Still, there is one thing she prioritizes.
If you just keep putting it off and, like, not building a faith because you're too busy, you're never going to get there, because it's just going to keep, you're going to keep getting more and more busy.
She says making time for her relationship with Jesus Christ has kept her grounded in college. And whether or not those around her on campus can relate, she gets this sense.
Even if we have no relationship with God and we don't know him, we all know that we have a desire for a relationship.
And a 2023 opinion poll from Gallup might indicate young people are open to that divine relationship. Data gathered for Americans ages 18 to 29 shows a total of 73% self-identify as either religious or spiritual.
Some data suggest young adults do have an openness to God, faith, or religion, but the question is, what will happen with that interest, and will it be developed?
For Kathleen, her Catholic faith developed as she grew up in the church.
I've always, like, pictured, like, whenever I was a kid, they were like, oh, Jesus walks beside you. Like, I would always picture as if, like, Jesus is walking beside me, or, like, where I could just, like, reach out and, like, hold his hand.
She has stuck with her faith during these college years, but she says it can be a time when people fall away.
You went to CCD or, like, Catholic school growing up, and it was something that you had to do at the time and that you were, like, being taken to, but it didn't necessarily, like, stick with you. And now that you are on your own, you don't necessarily know that you need to add that back into your life, because it's like, well, I did that for the past, like, 18 years.
In 2020, right before she was heading off to college, the COVID-19 pandemic and a nationwide shutdown tested her faith.
Every plan that I had, like, stopped that March, and I never, like, I didn't seem to have a plan anymore, and it was, my faith was what I could rely on, and it was like, well, this makes it make sense because there's a bigger picture here.
Kathleen says she struggles with perfectionism. It's something she sees other students dealing with as well.
I've really learned that, like, trusting God and letting him take control has helped me, like, relax, and there's things that when I've trusted in God, I've done better than what I could have done if I had tried to do it myself.
In order to develop her relationship with Christ during college, Kathleen has focused on a few things. And in the season of Lent, in preparation for Easter, she is trying to be more intentional. For one, she is cutting out social media.
You lose track of how long you scroll.
She is trying to limit distractions and make time for silence.
I think silence is really beautiful because it opens up your heart to be like more attuned to listening for God's voice.
At the St. Thomas More Oratory, the Catholic Student Center on campus, she has surrounded herself with good friends. And she can go to Mass in the chapel or drop in for silent prayer and spend time with Christ present in the Eucharist.
It's a feeling that like can't be expressed. And you just have to be open to that feeling, like giving your heart kind of and just being open and letting Jesus enter into it.
For many on campus, passing by the chapel could be a daily occurrence.
It's a battleground out there, like you're looking for those souls.
As the data indicates, young people can identify with religion or spirituality. But where do they go from there? Kathleen and her friends at the Catholic Student Center have a mindset that to help those who are lost, they have to go out.
This is like where we're going to start from, to kind of go out there and like find everybody else and like reach out to those people, because it can be hard on college campuses.
As she prepares for the next phase of her life after graduation, Kathleen's unsure about where she might live or work. Wherever she ends up, she'll likely have to make new friends and form new relationships.
I always have Christ, and I'll always be rooted in him, so that like 5 months down the road, when I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing with my life, I don't have a job, I'm not sure where I'm going, I at least know that there's going to be something, because I have faith and trust in God, and like I have that relationship.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in depth.
Data from the Pew Research Center suggests the majority of former Catholics leave the faith before the age of 24, making the college years an important time to reignite the faith life of a young adult. News headlines are next in the Week in Review. Haiti, Israel, Russia, and the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll be right back. In Haiti, continuing violence, chaos, and breakdown of any semblance of order top the news in the Week in Review. That as the U.S. government is now stepping in to help airlift stranded Americans out of the Haitian capital. Nearly 1,000 Americans are either living in or visiting Haiti. Those who want to leave have been effectively trapped, while roving armed gangs have shut down the main airport, blocked the main roads, looted neighborhoods, and mounted an attack at the country's central bank. Ordinary Haiti citizens' lives have been upended as they are forced to flee their homes and dodge bullets in the street. The armed gangs have gradually filled a power vacuum since the 2021 assassination of Haiti's president. And that violence has now spiraled out of control into a full-scale humanitarian crisis. Last week, a privately organized chopper mission rescued famed author Mitch Albom, his wife, and several other Americans out of Haiti. Albom is deeply committed to the Haitian people, having run an orphanage in Haiti for 14 years. He spoke to EWTN's Tracy Sable earlier this week about his work with children in Haiti and what he thinks needs to be done to quell the violence.
Most of our children come from backgrounds where they were either abandoned, some were left outside in the woods to die, some were dropped off at tuberculosis centers and no one ever came back for them, or malnutrition centers and no one came back for them. So when they get to our orphanage, which is a loving place with dormitories and kitchens and medical care and a playing field and a large, you know, large places to pray and to play, it's a haven. I mean, it's an oasis, and we try to get them to recognize that life can be this way, that life can be peaceful, that life can be educational and nutritious and loving and warm. And to provide that against the backdrop of the exact opposite is exactly the reason that we're there. It's the reason that we go every month, to try to show them with God's love and with human beings' love, there's hope. My hope is that some outside force right now will come in there and quell the gangs. That's the immediate thing that needs to happen. These people who are terrorizing the nation because they have guns and the rest of the country doesn't, could be dealt with the proper force. And then they have to have a fairly elected government that supported the idea of making Haiti better, not making their own pockets better, which is kind of the history of people who get elected in Haiti.
Right now, it is uncertain how long the U.S. government airlifts will last for those Americans who want to leave Haiti. The helicopter evacuation can take about 30 Americans out a day, depositing them in the neighboring country of the Dominican Republic. Once there safely, the evacuees will be responsible for organizing their own travel onward back to the United States. U.S. shuttle diplomacy continues in the Mideast as U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken traveled this week to Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and back to Israel to discuss ceasefire negotiations and to look ahead at a possible governance role for the Palestinian Authority once the war in Gaza is over. Blinken is talking with Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his war cabinet about alternatives to Israel's planned ground assault in the southern town of Rafah. A diplomatic stalemate at the United Nations on Friday after the UN Security Council failed to pass a resolution put forth by the United States calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. The resolution condemned the Hamas October 7th attack on Israel and the current restrictions on delivering humanitarian aid to Gaza and called for a sustained ceasefire tied to the release of Hamas hostages. The final vote on the 15-member council was 11 in favor, but Russia, China, and Algeria voted against it with one abstention. Russia still unable to condemn the Hamas attack that started the war. Russian President Vladimir Putin extended his term 6 more years with his re-election last weekend. In comments celebrating his victory, Putin declared his determination to advance deeper into Ukraine and dangled new threats against the West. Having cracked down on all dissent, the harshest since the days of the Soviet Union, Putin's re-election was never in doubt. Any viable challenger has either met an untimely death, is jailed, or is in exile. Putin's 25 years in power make him the longest-serving Kremlin leader since Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin. But despite repressing all dissent, there were quiet signs of protest. As voter lines swelled inside Russia and at its embassies around the world last Sunday, the last day of voting. Before his death in a Siberian prison last month, Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny endorsed the idea of noon against Putin, where those opposed to his regime and his war in Ukraine would show up in silent protest. Navalny's widow joined the long and vocal lines of Russian voters that wound around the block at the Russian embassy in Berlin, Germany. Those long lines were evident in other cities, like London, and in Russia itself. In this voter line in Moscow, Russians knew they had to keep their displeasure silent and subdued. A free speech case at the U.S. Supreme Court might be leaning in the Biden administration's favor. The case of Murthy versus Missouri arose out of concerns of misinformation and fake news on social media in the wake of COVID-19 and the 2020 presidential election. Attorneys general from Missouri and Louisiana argue the Biden administration and federal agencies like the FBI coerced changes on social media platforms. The White House says there are no instances of such coercion with threats of adverse government action. On Monday, justices seemed broadly skeptical during plaintiff arguments that the administration unconstitutionally squelched conservative points of view. A decision on this case is expected by early summer. Without comment, the Supreme Court has decided not to review a Catholic couple's lawsuit about custody of their transgender-identifying son. Mary and Jeremy Cox brought their case to the Supreme Court after Indiana Child Services removed their son from their custody because they refused to use his preferred pronouns, citing their profound Christian beliefs. We brought you extensive coverage of this case on EWTN News in Depth a few weeks ago. This means the couple will not regain custody of their son. Lori Windham, vice president at the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty, served as counsel for the Foxes. In response to the Supreme Court's decision to decline the case, she said, "Loving parents should not lose custody of their children because they disagree with the state about gender. We are confident that the Supreme Court will ultimately protect this basic right and ensure that parents can raise their children consistent with their religious beliefs." We'll be right back.
We have more than 1,500 colors.
A full palette of colors for a full range of creativity. Stained glass, mosaics, frescoes, sculpture, wrought iron, and more. We go to the workshops of the famed Progetto Arte Poli in Verona, Italy, when we return.
the beauty of handcrafted glass art in the old tradition. EWTN News In Depth recently took a trip to Verona, Italy for a masterclass in the beauty of stained glass and the intricacies of how it's made. Most, but not all, is destined for church beautification projects around the world. Here's correspondent Colin Flynn.
In a workshop outside the city of Verona in the north of Italy, incredible work is being carried out to create beautiful art and stained glass windows. The attention to detail, the time, and the skill needed to create these works of art is immense. And from here, these stained glass windows are shipped to churches all over the world. This artist studio is the largest in Italy, with over 60 people employed. Anna Piggy is the exporting manager and is showing me around.
For a lot of people, they think it's kind of these kind of art forms have stopped, or that there are just a few people working with the hands. So they feel like, you know, when you open the entrance door, you feel like time has stopped. Everyone working with the hands, creating masterpieces.
Walking around, the first thing that hits you is the vibrant colours, all thousands of them.
We're looking at thousands of pieces of glass,
yes.
All different colours.
Exactly. Consider that we have more than 1,500 colours.
Wow.
So you can even see, like, for the blues, if you would like to have a blue window,
yeah.
You can choose whatever kind of the bluish, the more cobalt, more watercolor.
So it's not as simple as calling up and saying, I want a blue stained glass window.
So choosing the right color is extremely difficult.
The history of Progetto Arti Poli begins in 1953, when Master Albano Poli opened a small art shop in the center of Verona. It was post-World War II, and many churches' stained glass windows had been damaged.
I believe there would be a lot of work to do in so many churches to fix what had been destroyed by the war. So I started the work. I created a small business in San Fermo di Verona, which was sponsored by the local parish. They gave me a workshop to work in for free.
Despite Italy having a post-war crippled economy and prospects looking bleak, Master Poli was determined to make his stained glass workshop successful. And with hard work, over the years, his work became well known in Italy, then in other parts of Europe. Then they broke into the US, China, and other parts of the world. The business had become a great success.
If you believe in your work, you will get results. I always believed in the work I was doing.
Today, the workshop produces not just stained glass windows, but also mosaics, sculptures, and ironworks. Everything be made by hand.
It takes experience, but you learn everything with passion, and it is very rewarding. Glass is beautiful. It is a complex material, and starting from scratch, you create a piece, a work.
On the other side of the workshop, Diageo is restoring the welds between pieces of stained glass. He's been working here for over 40 years.
I work in the welding and restoration of stained glass windows. The passion is always there. I enjoy the work. I put everything into it to do my best.
That passion is being handed down to the new generation. And this is very much a family business, as the company is now run by Master Poli's son. And also working here full-time are Master's two grandchildren, Alberto and Andrea.
It's a workplace that fills you a lot of emotion, because you work with beautiness, you work with colors, you work with art, you work with ideas.
Really feel pride whenever I come here and I see what a big company my granddad built from nothing. So it's an honor for me to work here.
It's no surprise the boys have ended up working here, because growing up, this was their life.
Do you both have memories from childhood of being here in the workshop and running around?
Yeah, we always used to come here, like during summer, whenever we didn't have school, we come here and we draw some sketches and do some stuff here.
Causing trouble.
Yeah, a bit, yeah. I always felt it inside of me. I always felt it was the right thing to do.
You know, when we grew up in this thing, so it's very part of us.
Alberto works in the workshop, while Andrea works mainly in the office.
Working with churches allows you to do like bigger projects in terms of sizing of the things you do. But I'm really fascinated also by the design part with like cooler design pieces.
Today, Artipoli's biggest client is the Catholic Church. This stained glass window is about to be shipped to a cathedral in Beijing, China. But they also produce artistic works for large hotels, for kings and queens, and other extremely wealthy individuals.
We work mainly for churches and cathedrals all over the world. But a lot of times architects come and they always have a hotel that you're also doing, or like a residence, or a palace. So we get to do also works that are beyond the church works.
So this would be though in the realm of royalty and nobility.
Exactly. Unfortunately, I cannot tell you names, but I can tell you that we get phone calls from Dubai to China, to Middle East, you know, to US, so a lot of different places.
One of Artipoli's private clients is a Syrian man who is building a villa in Dubai. He has sent a designer to the workshop to check on the artwork's progress.
We have a huge dome that is designed by us and collaborated, of course, and manufactured here in Artipoli. It's an amazing masterpiece, I can say. We have also a very detailed and important handrail inside the villa. It's a huge also work of art. It's made of iron and a lot of gold leaf. My client is very happy so as well.
And for Master Poli, at 88 years young, he says this workshop has given him meaning and purpose throughout his life.
For me, my joy, my life is here. Some people search for it all over the world. But for me, my joy is here.
And eventually, that joy will be left to his grandchildren, who will be the ones bringing it forward into the future, even with plans to possibly start a school here to keep the craftsmanship alive.
The techniques are all the same, so they don't change since 500 years. So the technique, the handwork, the craftsmanship will be always the same.
And so it's an honor for me, and it's a duty, a must to carry it on in time.
What are your hopes and dreams for the future?
Just honor what my grandfather did and try to make him proud.
In Verona, Colm Flynn, EWTN News in Depth.
That does it for this edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Montse Alvarado. Next week at this time, our program will be preempted by Holy Week coverage on the EWTN network. Join us for Holy Week celebrations and reflections here on EWTN. We will be back on April 5th. See you then.